traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Want him in prison, and this is what we need to understand.
So true.
David Brock and some of these organizations have already raised tens of millions of dollars for an impeachment process. Then they want jail to the chief. They need to understand that this is a war. We are so far beyond normal politics, Sean. We are in a very dangerous moment. And while President Trump is a very strong leader and a man of strong constitution, he was able to survive all of this during the campaign and get elected president. When you're president and you are faced with the kind of monolithic opposition you were talking about, plus a federal bureaucracy that is completely out to undermine him every day, the intelligence community that is engaged in some of this as well that we have heard, I hope to God that he is strong enough to withstand this. They are out to destroy him because if he succeeds, the country changes for the good, and they must not allow that to happen.
Hey guys, I'm Monica Crowley, and this is the Monica Crowley Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me as we begin to end yet another week. We have survived it, barely, but we've survived it. This is your go-to for hot liberty, a safe space for all of us thought criminals, independent thinkers, and happy warriors. On social media, Instagram at Monica Crowley _, and on Twitter and True Social at Monica Crowley. Also by email at monicacrowleypodcast@gmail.com. All right, next week I'm very excited because we have some really big shows lined up for you. We are going to talk with Ambassador Rick Grenell about the global threats we face in view of Biden's exceedingly dangerous weakness. So we'll talk to him about where we are in the world and where we're going. We're also going to talk next week to the one and only Jack Posobiec. Jack is absolutely phenomenal. You know his work at Human Events, Human Events Live, all over X and True Social. He really is quite something. So he's become a friend, and I'm so excited that he is going to make his debut appearance right here on the Monica Crowley Podcast next week. So big shows lined up. You're not going to want to miss a second of this show. Later today, we're going to be joined by Charlie Spearing of the Daily Mail, previously of Breitbart and the Washington Examiner. He's got a fantastic new book exposing Kamala Harris. It's so good. You're not going to want to miss this, too. He is just moments away. But first, the Monica Memo. If a tree falls in a forest and there's no one there to hear it, does it make a sound? We're going to apply that existential question to what is going on today. Biden speaks, no one cares. And tonight, he's going to deliver a pack of lies in primetime. And no one cares. We have to cover it, but again, no one cares. He's going to give his third State of the Union address, takes place tonight on Capitol Hill. And here's what we should expect. Biden has invited 17 family members of the Hamas hostages, which is a good thing. Guys, there are 6 American hostages still being held by Hamas, in addition to all of the Israeli hostages that are still being held by this terrorist group. So he is inviting 17 family members. That is a good thing. Along with released hostages, Mia Shem, who has been invited not by Biden, but by House Speaker Mike Johnson. She spent more than 50 days in captivity and had to have surgery while being held prisoner. Can you imagine? Other guests tonight of the Democrats will be abortion rights activists. Okay, and they've got a whole panoply of radicals that are coming tonight. But also, courtesy of the GOP, you've got some pro-life activists coming, some Gold Star families of the Kabul blast. They're going to be there tonight as well. Parents of the American journalist detained in Russia, NYPD officers attacked by those illegals in Times Square. They're coming courtesy of Republican members of New York's congressional delegation. Congresswoman Nicole Malliotakis and Congressman Anthony D'Esposito. So good for them for inviting those cops who really bore the brunt of the illegal invasion by being beaten up thanks to Biden's wide open border. Now, Congressman Mike Collins did invite the parents of Laken Riley, who is that 22-year-old nursing student who was killed in Georgia by an illegal alien, but those parents politely declined the invitation. Congressman Collins posted the following on X, quote, "I invited Laken Riley's parents to the State of the Union address, but understandably they have chosen to stay home as they grieve the loss of their daughter. Therefore, the seat reserved for my guest will remain vacant to honor Laken and all American victims of illegal alien crime." As Joe Biden attempts to paint a rosy picture of the crime-ridden country he has created, he will look up at an empty seat that memorializes those we've lost because of his open border policies. Well, good for Congressman Collins. It's such an important gesture. Not an empty gesture, a really meaningful one, so good for him. Will Biden acknowledge her and say her name in his speech tonight? Not likely. Don't hold your breath. As I said in the previous show this week, and if you haven't heard Tuesday's show, please go listen to it. Joe Biden, like all communists, and I do use the word communist, and look, please understand that the people taking the country off the cliff deliberately right now are communists. Or at the very least, they are useful idiots of the communists. Okay, because we have some real dumbbells who are useful idiots, in Lenin's words, who run around doing the dirty work of the communists without really understanding what they're doing. But the people pulling the strings certainly understand. So you got the communists destroying the country and the useful idiots helping them to do it. Communists do not acknowledge the individual. Communism is all about the collective being led, controlled, and run by the people at the top, the vanguard, according to Karl Marx. So, Joe Biden is in the vanguard, whether he's aware of it or not, and they do not acknowledge the individual. That is why they do not single out Laken Riley. It's not only because singling her death out would make them look bad politically and be damaging to them politically because of their asinine, deliberate open border policy, but because they are communists who don't acknowledge the individual. Understand the bigger picture here behind all of this. This is why you come to this show, for the bigger picture. Biden apparently tonight is going to talk about Ukraine, Israel. He's going to blame the Republicans for border security and the border crisis. And he's going to claim that Bidenomics is working and the economy is doing fabulous. All lies. All lies. Senator Katie Britt of Alabama is going to deliver the GOP response to Biden. That is always the most unglamorous, thankless job in Washington. You never want to go after the sitting president. I don't care who you are. It's just never quite good. Some people do it better than others, and we'll see how Katie Britt does tonight. She's an up-and-coming star in the GOP, so we will be watching that. And if you thought that President Trump would just be sitting at home quietly watching the lies go by unchallenged, think again. Trump announced that he's going to be doing another play-by-play live on Biden's State of the Union on Truth Social. So we'll be watching that. I will also be live tweeting the speech tonight. So please follow me on Twitter and Truth Social at Monica Crowley for all of my extremely incisive and witty insights. We will be taking apart all of the lies. Meanwhile, as you watch these members of Congress tonight, understand that they just passed a $6 billion fiscal year 2024 funding package for the government They passed this package, which Speaker Johnson is calling a minibus as opposed to an omnibus, but the language doesn't matter. It's all semantics. Trillions of dollars out the door as of today. The House passed it 339 votes to 85. Only 85 members of Congress voted against this monstrosity. So I want you to understand that nobody will ever vote their way out of this. We had this conversation on Tuesday on this show with Lee Rizzuto. And again, if you haven't heard Tuesday's show, please go back and listen. It was critical. As we were talking about a nation carrying over $34 trillion in debt. And now we are running up $1 trillion in debt every 90 to 100 days. So there is no incentive, guys. In government, there is no profit incentive the way there is with a private company or a public company where you have to meet a bottom line and answer to consumers and answer to shareholders and answer to a board. There's none of that in government. The only incentive in government is power and getting reelected. And the way they think they get reelected is by spending us into oblivion. So nobody here in Congress is ever going to vote our way out of this. They're just not. So understand that these people that you're watching tonight sitting in Congress are economic arsonists. They're economic arsonists pouring fuel over this already raging debt fire. They are voting to enslave you and your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren and beyond to $1 trillion every 3 months. Absorb that. $1 trillion every 3 months. So actually, all of these people are mocking you. They're mocking the country as they take it off the cliff, and they're mocking you. Other people mocking you include the crew over at MSDNC, and that includes Jen Psaki and Rachel Maddow, who on Super Tuesday night took to the airwaves to mock Virginia voters, and by extension all of us, for whom illegal immigration and the wide open border is our top issue. So, you know, exit polls come in, and general polling comes in, and these clowns on MSDNC took a look and saw that illegal immigration was the number one issue. And generally speaking, it's the number one issue for the country. And not just Republican voters, but Democrats too now. Especially Black voters and Latina voters, they're in these cities and they are pissed, because their entire communities are being overrun by illegal immigrants that are getting all of the benefits. They're getting all of the cream that was meant for minority communities. So while Rachel Maddow and Jen Psaki are sitting there making fun of Republican voters who are concerned about the wide open border and the assault of illegal aliens, well, people in their own party are really pissed too, but they won't say that. So they went on the air to mock these voters for caring about their country and their communities. Here they are having a really good laugh at your expense.
I mean, if you look at some of these exit polls, I mean, I live in Virginia. Immigration was the number one issue. Yeah. Again, these could change in Virginia.
Well, Virginia does have a border with West Virginia. Very, very contested area.
Build a wall. Like, what?
That was Rachel Maddow at the end, by the way, laughingly saying that, oh, well, Virginia shares a border with West Virginia. So she's putting down the people of Virginia and putting down the people of West Virginia, insulting everybody here with their condescending clapback. Guys, this is the kind of exchange that can help win the election for Donald Trump. Because it shows the absolute condescension these people have for you. Their cavalier disregard for you and the things you care about and hold dear. Like the rule of law. Like law and order. Like a secure border. like your desire to live without worry about crime, like not having your community overrun with illegal aliens, like wanting a sovereign country, like wanting strong presidential leadership. They mock these things as they destroy these things. You've got Americans being murdered at the hands of illegal aliens like Lake and Riley, and 100,000 plus Americans being killed every year by fentanyl coming across the border. You have skyrocketing crime. You've got terrorists coming in. All of our systems being overwhelmed and collapsed, all on purpose. And these people are laughing at you for noticing that, noticing that they're tearing the country apart on purpose and caring about it and wanting to stop it. It reminds me of Obama's comment that we, quote, cling to our guns and our religion. Remember that? And then there was Mrs. Clinton's remark that we're all just a bunch of deplorables in a basket. Remember that? This is what the regime thinks of you. They hate you. Look at what they just did on the spending package. Every single day, they say things, they do things, they take votes that show you exactly who they are and what they believe. They hate you. They hate you for who you are, what you believe, and for standing in their way as they try to destroy our country. They despise you for that. And their contempt drips from every pore. And that contempt helped to elect Donald Trump in 2016 and will do so again this year. Speaking of the contempt that they have for you, let's talk about Air Biden, shall we? This is the newest American airline. Did you not know that? Yes, you can now choose from, well, you can't because you're legal. But illegals now apparently can choose from Southwest, Delta, and now Air Biden to come into the country. In addition to the millions of illegals who have crossed our border since Biden took office, the Center for Immigration Studies found that last year, from January 23 to December 23, with the use of the CBP, Customs and Border Patrol, One app, okay, the Biden administration has been flying 320,000 illegals from Latin American airports right over the border and right into 43 American cities just over the last 12 months. Treason? 100%. They're not even waiting for them to approach the border. They are literally picking them up, busing them to an airport, boarding them on airplanes without any vetting, without any ID. You try to get on an airplane without an ID. Good luck to you. But if you're an illegal, Chinese national, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Iranian terrorist, doesn't matter. You can just walk on board Air Biden and they will fly you into the country across the border, making your life so much easier. You no longer have to go through the Darien Gap and schlep all the way up through Central America, get to the border, pay off the cartels. No, no, no. Now you just have to board an airplane. No ID, no nothing. No judicial review. Get on the plane and they will fly you right in. 100% treasonous acts here. Elon Musk raised the alarm on this to his 175 million followers on X by tweeting the following, quote, "Treason indeed. Ushering in vast numbers of illegals is why Secretary Mayorkas was impeached by the House. This is why groups on the far left fight so hard to stop voter ID requirements under the absurd guise of protecting the right to vote." That CBP One app allows illegals to apply for parole in the U.S. Illegals from Mexico have used the app over 64 million times, requesting to come into the United States. The app is promoted by the White House, And the White House has tried to establish this as the main entryway into America for those seeking, quote, asylum. So the whole asylum system has been blown to smithereens and completely abused as a pathway to get millions of people into this country. Under Biden, the number of illegals has doubled. In 2020, and again, these are official estimates, so way low ball, there were 10.2 million illegals, and again, so they say. Remember, this illegal immigration invasion has been going on for decades, so nobody actually knows the number of illegals in this country, and it's probably closer to, I don't know, 30, 40 million? Remember, they've been telling us for years that it's 11 million illegals in the country. So they're sticking to that general number. Absurd. You can't have 11 million illegals as a static number over a bajillion years. The number only goes one way, and that's up. So we are probably at 30 to 40 million, maybe more. I don't know. 20 million is the population of the state of New York. Just to put things in perspective. Getting back to voting and safe and secure elections, Elon Musk is talking about voter ID. He's talking about how this administration is allowing in millions of illegals before an election. And thank God he's out there. He's such a prominent voice. And good on him for raising this issue. And he's also raising the issue of like, hey, man, the left is totally opposed to voter ID. And there can only be one reason for that. And that's because they cheat. The only way they can win because their communist ideas are so destructive and hated is by stealing elections, rigging them and stealing them. And the way they do that is mass mail-in balloting, where it's completely unvetted and out of control, and then importing all of these voters. They're in the country illegally. States like New Jersey just mail out ballots to every single address, whether you request one or not. And so these illegals are there filling out the ballots. And then get this. The Attorney General Merrick Garland, who after the president is the number one law enforcement officer in the United States, has now gone to war with voter ID and other laws to ensure safe and secure elections. Merrick Garland over the last week slammed voter ID laws as discriminatory and unnecessary. Again, the number one law enforcement officer after the president is going to war with voter ID. He spoke last Sunday along with Kamala Harris, and we're going to talk about her with Charlie Spearing here in just a couple of minutes. But he was in Selma, Alabama on the city's 59th anniversary of the 1965 civil rights event, dubbed Bloody Sunday. And there, Garland decided to bring up the history of black voting rights, claiming that, quote, the right to vote is still under attack. Give me one example of somebody being denied the right to vote. It's absurd. This is the big lie. And they did this when Georgia passed their election laws to tighten up, to make sure that voter fraud could not happen in that state, or at least minimize it. And remember, holy hell broke loose. Oh, you're marginalizing minorities, black voters, they can't get IDs. It's all so insulting and such lies. And actually, a bunch of people went down to talk to black voters in Georgia, and they're like, hey, can you get an ID? And they're like, yeah, I drive, I board airplanes. Yeah, I know how to get an ID. To suggest a black person cannot get an ID in Georgia or anywhere else in America is so racist and insulting. And yet, the left, the communists, get away with it because they're also the media. So there's nobody there to point out these facts and hold them to account. Garland went on to say, quote, there are many things that are open to debate in America. One thing that must not be open for debate is the right for all eligible citizens to vote and to have their vote counted. Well, duh. And then they create the straw man. Garland has said that the Supreme Court decisions have weakened the 1965 Voting Rights Act. He added that some voter ID laws and redistricting maps have put minority groups at a disadvantage. So again, playing the race card and fear-mongering. He went on to say that voting restrictions, quote, threaten the foundation of our system of government. Again, the people screaming the loudest about threats to democracy are, in fact, the threats to democracy. Garland went on, quote, that is why the Justice Department is fighting back. This is why one of the first things I did when I came into office was to double the size of the voting section of the Civil Rights Division. That is why we are challenging efforts by states and jurisdictions to implement discriminatory, burdensome, and unnecessary restrictions on access to the ballot, including those related to mail-in voting, the use of drop boxes, and voter ID requirements. All of the things that we absolutely are fighting against, right? Mail-in voting, mass mail-in balloting, use of drop boxes, all of the slush fund areas that the Democrats use to cheat. We are fighting those, and Merrick Garland is standing up defending these and going to war with voter ID requirements. What he is actually telling you here, your attorney general, is that, in other words, we can't win without stealing, so we're going to make it easier for us to steal elections. Speaking of elections, Super Tuesday this week was an absolute blowout by President Trump. Nikki Haley just got absolutely destroyed. Trump is clearly on the march to wrapping up this nomination probably next week, certainly by March 19th. He will have enough delegates to be the nominee. So this race is over. He dominated with wins 15 out of the 16 states and jurisdictions that held races on Tuesday. Nikki Haley won only Vermont and the swamp, Washington, D.C., both, of course, way out there, outliers. Okay, so Nikki Haley then suspended her campaign, and she wished Trump well, but she refused to endorse him.
I am filled with the gratitude for the outpouring of support we've received from all across our great country. But the time has now come to suspend my campaign. I said I wanted Americans to have their voices heard. I have done that. I have no regrets. In all likelihood, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee when our party convention meets in July. I congratulate him and wish him well. I wish anyone well who would be America's president. Our country is too precious to let our differences divide us.
You know, that kind of thing just makes Nikki Haley look petty and small. And actually, this was quite disgraceful on her part not to endorse. Governor DeSantis did it the right way. He withdrew from the race and then endorsed immediately Donald Trump. That is the way to do it with a man who is not a run-of-the-mill candidate like you, Nikki, but actually a man leading an entire movement that has tremendous ideological, political, and emotional pull. So Nikki Haley is biting her nose to spite her face, but whatever, she's irrelevant now. While everybody is focused on the GOP side of things and all of the excitement around Donald Trump, people in the imperial media and beyond are ignoring what is happening on the Democrat side because they do not want you to know this. But while Biden is winning these primaries, there are major weaknesses in his candidacy. And it's not just because he's senile, it's because of his catastrophic presidency. This is an historic catastrophe. And a lot of voters on the Democrat side are fed up, and they're fed up either because they think he's not left enough, like younger voters, Arab voters who are really angry over his support for Israel over Hamas, at least to this point. He's changing his tune now. But you've got big policy differences on the left. Younger voters are like done with him. So you have big fractures here, and it's coming out in these primaries in not insignificant ways. A lot of these voters are choosing uncommitted or none of the above over Joe Biden. North Carolina, 88,000 voters, or nearly 13%, voted no preference. Minnesota, about 45,000 to 50,000 voters, no preference. Massachusetts, and again, these are left-wing states, right? Massachusetts, over 54,000 voters, or just under 10%, no preference. Colorado, over 43,000 voters, or 8% of the vote, voted non-committed delegate. So Biden and the Democrats have real problems here. Real problems. And just because the left, the Democrats, and the imperial media are covering it up doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Oh, it exists. And the chickens are going to come home to roost. All right, let's hit a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about Kamala Harris. Speaking of the Democrats' options, God help us. We're going to talk about that with Charlie Spearing of the Daily Mail, who's just written an expose on Kamala Harris, not to be missed. Sit tight. The erosion of our food supply is a pressing concern in today's world. The prevalence of diseases and the number of Americans getting sick continues to rise because of the practices associated with commercial farming, the use of fertilizers, chemical sprays, and the proliferation of bioengineered foods. We deserve better. We deserve food that will nourish our bodies, not break them down. And Freedom Farms believes that too. Straight from beautiful upstate New York, Freedom Farms, founded and operated by great American patriots, are leading the charge in restoring faith in food production by providing an alternative that is natural, healthy, and unadulterated. The farm raises grass-fed, grass-finished beef, pasture-raised pork, and free-range pastured chickens. But the best part about all of this is that all of their meats are 100% vaccine-free and hormone-free. And did I mention, you can even buy up to a whole cow and pig. Delicious and healthy meats processed at a small family-owned butcher shop and delivered right to your front door. It's time we take control of our food supply. Check out Freedom Farms today by visiting wearefreedomfarms.com. And don't forget to use code MONICA25 for $25 off your first order. Wearefreedomfarms.com, code MONICA25 for $25 off your very first order. Check out my friends at Freedom Farms for the very best meat you will ever have. Wearefreedomfarms.com, code MONICA25. Well, I am so psyched to welcome today Charlie Spearing. Charlie is the Washington political reporter for the Daily Mail, which I read multiple times a day. And I have to say the reporting and Charlie's work at the Daily Mail is fantastic. But my guilty pleasure is the female section on the right hand side. And I can see Charlie is laughing at me, but the female section of celebrity gossip on the right hand side of the Daily Mail website is my escapism, and I make no apologies for that. Previously, Charlie was at the Washington Examiner. He was also at Breitbart News, and he's got an important and fun and also horrifying new book out called Amateur Hour, Kamala Harris in the White House. It's a fantastic book. It's available now wherever books are sold, so go get it. He joins us now. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, how are you? Yeah, the celebrity side of the Daily Mail keeps us humble. That's where we get a majority of our traffic. We are in no means believe that we are somehow more important than the daily celebrity gossip that the Mail does so well producing.
Well, you guys do it the best, I would say, and it is my escapism because Lord knows the world is so insane that if we focus too much on it, we'll all go crazy. So I find myself at night, like around 9 o'clock at night, going to the Daily Mail just to get my celebrity gossip in the female section. So thank you for that. But thank you for your great work at the Daily Mail and your whole long career, Charlie. And it's just so great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. And congrats on this book. You know what's remarkable as I was going through this book, preparing for our conversation, it struck me that, you know, sort of like Barack Obama, who came out of nowhere, you know, he was in Illinois, but then he comes out of nowhere and bam, he is at the top of the national scene, making decisions that affect all of us and the future of the country. And nobody, with Obama, nobody ever did a deep dive into his background. So in 2008, we essentially elected a stranger. And in many ways, Obama is still a stranger. One of the clever things that people on the left do, like Obama, is they end up writing their memoir or their autobiography, or in Obama's case, two autobiographies, before they intend to sort of catapult themselves into the national scene. And so that is a clever way for them to put their story out and therefore preempt any kind of digging into their background. So Obama did that very effectively. Now, Kamala did not go that route, but maybe she was considered such a non-entity that nobody ever thought to delve into her background and her political career. Nobody until you. So when you took a look at this and you said, wait a minute, we've got a woman as vice president of the United States and nobody knows anything about her. Is that what led you to writing this book?
Yeah, absolutely. Just the first motivation, of course, was the fact that we're going into the 2024 election with President Joe Biden, the oldest president ever, running for re-election. You know, we don't normally do a big expose on a vice president, right? We didn't do any big treatises on Vice President Al Gore. But when you look down the path, when you look down the future of politics, there's a very real possibility that Kamala Harris could be the 47th president of the United States. If Biden does run and make it to November and win, then it's only a matter of time before Kamala takes over. Joe Biden has to step down, and doing so without ever running a successful presidential campaign on her own.
Charlie, how have you ever, and we're going to get into her background because you do so much great investigative digging into her background and who she really is. But before we get into those details, have you ever seen anybody fail up like Kamala Harris?
No, it's really uncanny. And the more I researched her background, you know, failure after failure, but continuing to move forward, it really sort of demonstrates what happens when you work in like a one-party state like California. And we kind of saw this with Obama too, but even Obama had a few political successes despite his many failures. And most famously, Obama had that famous speech in 2004 at the convention where he said, you know, there's no red states, there's no blue states. And that's when he really sort of kicked off the Obama brand that seized the imagination of all the mainstream media. Kamala never really had these moments, but she still had the attention of the elite and the mainstream influencers in the community, in the party, but she never really had the same sizzle as Obama had. And even though they really tried to sell her as the next Obama, I spent a good deal of time sort of examining how the elites really carried water for her for so long, even when she kicked off her presidential campaign. If you remember, she was one of the most talked about and, you know, predicted to be one of the most successful candidates. But wow, that did not happen when her presidential campaign launched. It went just... sky, it just plunged into irrelevancy, and ultimately, you know, she ultimately had to end her campaign before she even got to votes in Iowa.
Yeah, because her fellow Democrats who knew her best took one look at her on the national stage and said, I don't think so. But then Joe Biden took a look at that and said, I want that for my VP. All right, we're going to get into that. Let's go back. Who is she? Like, who is Kamala Harris as a person? Where and how did she grow up? What were her parents like?
Yeah, she's the product of, you know, a pretty substantial elite academics. Her parents went to school in San Francisco to Berkeley, and her parents were also members of this Afro-American study group that was very radical, even for Berkeley. It was considered Marxist. You know, they hailed as their heroes, you know, Chairman Mao, Fidel Castro. So there was a very intellectual underpinning between her father and her mother when they were at school together. They met through this group, and that's how the relationship began. By the age of 5, her parents had split. By the age of 7, they finally officially divorced. But Kamala really had, you know, a very radical father who was very intellectual. But, you know, after that, she just became sort of the daughter of a hardworking single mother. And then she very much became sort of a product of a widespread group of women who sort of put themselves together and were really, you know, kind of a very strong, supportive female community. But she really lost the influence of her father from that moment after the split.
So after the split, though, she was considered something of a socialite in San Francisco. Is that right?
Right. Kamala's political career began when she started dating Willie Brown. And we always hear about Willie Brown in the comment sections of, you know, so many articles.
Yes. Let's talk about Willie Brown, shall we?
And there's a real truth. It's a real important relationship for Kamala. You know, it's considered untasteful to talk about it, but it really is important to how she got on the scene in San Francisco. At the age of 29, she's relatively unremarkable prosecutor from Alameda County, but meets Willie Brown at a wedding, and Willie Brown is 60 years old. He's running for mayor of San Francisco, and Kamala is 29, and they start dating. And in the year that they date, she is lifted up in a very unprecedented way. She's appointed to several state boards where she's making hundreds of thousands of dollars just by virtue of being Willie Brown's girlfriend. She made $400,000 over a period of a couple of years. Adjust that for inflation, that's almost $1 million in today's money. And then Willie Brown's arm, he introduced her to the important people in San Francisco, the important people in California politics. So that's really how she became known in San Francisco society. And the relationship only lasted about a year after Willie Brown won his campaign for mayor. They separated, and that was the end of that relationship.
So is it fair to say, let me ask you this. Do you think that relationship was a real romantic relationship? Or do you think it was mutually beneficial, where both of them were trading favors for more power, money, influence in San Francisco, or maybe a combination of both?
I think it was a combination of both. Willie Brown certainly needed to demonstrate that he was long estranged from his wife, Blanche, and had the reputation of being a playboy and a party guy, really had a hard time keeping a stable relationship. So by dating Kamala, and you see this in the tabloids in San Francisco, they really saw Kamala as proof that the mayor had sort of grown up and could hold a stable relationship with an adult woman. And so, and even his campaign manager spoke about the relationship as beneficial for Brown. And for Kamala, you know, obviously beneficial for her, because it introduces her to high society in San Francisco, gets her political foot in the door, to where she's uniquely positioned to run for office herself after the relationship ends. You know, Willie Brown was the one that ended it. And I think there was a time where Kamala thought maybe the relationship would continue on and be serious. But it after he won his race for mayor, it was pretty clear that he didn't no longer wanted the relationship. And then, you know, it was his estranged wife, Blanche, that showed up and held the Bible while he took his oath.
How ambitious was Kamala Harris? I mean, we assume all of these people are super ambitious, but did she seek out Willie Brown? Like, did she target him to try to seduce him and get him into a relationship so that he would help her? Or did that relationship develop organically?
I think it was a little bit of both. When they first met socially, I think it was very clear that, you know, she's an attractive young woman at the age of 29. So I think that Brown certainly, you know, took an eye, he had an eye for those kinds of relationships. And so I think it was very much began as, you know, just an organic attraction, but it's quickly moved into full gear as it progressed.
You know, let's talk about another big California figure with regard to Kamala, and that's Gavin Newsom. Gavin Newsom was mayor of San Francisco for a while before he becomes governor of the state. What is their relationship like? Are they competitors? Do they complement each other? What is their history?
Yeah, the people I spoke to in California described them as frenemies, right? So they were both proteges of Willie Brown. Gavin Newsom was the one that took over for mayor after Willie Brown stepped down. And Kamala went into the prosecutor's office and became district attorney and then attorney general. Both very ambitious, both, you know, had the eye and the support of the Democrat elite in the state, which is very important if you want to move forward politically. And when that race for governor came up, when Gavin Newsom was eyeing the governor's race after Jerry Brown, I believe, Kamala Harris was very much in the running at the same time. So they're both sort of eyeing the race for governor California was really scared. The Democrat elite don't necessarily like nasty fights that high, and they would rather settle it behind the scenes. And so as they're both eyeing this race, suddenly Barbara Boxer steps down from her Senate seat, opening up this release valve for either Gavin or Kamala to run for the office. Gavin said he didn't want to run for it. Kamala ended up taking it because it seemed like a way that she could move her political career forward without having to clash with Newsom.
It's so interesting. And you're right. California, like New York and Illinois and some other states, are one party state, which is the definition of communism. So there you go. But the egos, the egos are still at play because human nature is human nature, whether you're in a republic or in a communist system. So you always have these kinds of rivalries. Let's take a step back. Talk to us a little bit about her career as a prosecutor, because not a lot of people know how she got that position and then how she carried out her job as a prosecutor.
Yeah, and when she first ran for prosecutor, it was during when Willie Brown was mayor. He was clashing pretty extensively with the district attorney at the time, Terrence Hollinon, who was very much a progressive prosecutor, kind of, you know, had light penalties for low level crimes, but he was earning a lot of rage from the people of San Francisco who didn't like their city. You know, this is way back. This was an issue. You know, it's such an issue now, but it was an issue way back in the early 2000s when this was happening. And so Kamala ran as kind of a centrist, right? She kind of ran as a tough on crime. You know, well, her famous line was, "We don't have to be tough on crime or weak on crime. We have to be smart on crime." But in her campaign, she was very much aggressive and criticized Hollinon for his progressive approach to crime, and kind of ran as a centrist, and ultimately won her race with the support of Willie Brown and a lot of elites within the community that had turned on Hollinon and sort of blamed him for the problems that San Francisco was having.
Yeah, it's a fascinating tale. And this is all going on before she gets to the vice presidency. And actually before that, as you mentioned earlier, she ran for president in 2020. A lot of people forget about that. And it was infamously unsuccessful because she was so bad. She was like an epic flop. Why do you think that was? Why do you think that the appeal that so many saw in her in California did not translate nationally?
Yeah, I think it's very much a product of being part of a one-party system in California. to where she had already convinced all the elites that she was ready to launch her presidential campaign. But when she hit the trail and tried to talk to voters, it went very badly for her. She was very unprepared and didn't take the time to understand a lot of the issues that she was talking about. She would often had to revise and revisit her statements, what she really believed in. And I think voters in Iowa quickly saw what a lot of other people were seeing, is that she had a very, very intense ambition to be president, but she kind of forgot to sort of build this lasting, purposeful reason for running, and really failed at capturing the imaginations of voters. By the end of her campaign, just looking at all of her complaints, she really kind of lost the idealism of running for president, and kind of turned into grievance politics, where she blamed racism and sexism among voters for not backing her, not supporting her, and but refusing to address her own problems. She tried to attack Joe Biden during the debate, but kind of backed away from that. So many situations where she tried to reboot in her campaign on different issues, but they ended up just failing completely.
She cannot speak. I mean, let's cut to the chase here, Charlie. I mean, I don't know what her level of intelligence is, but when people cannot communicate effectively, whether they're just natively intelligent or not, it comes off as not being so bright. And then when you pair that with her natural awkwardness with people, I mean, she's certainly not a retail politician. She doesn't like to press the flesh. She's the exact opposite of, Bill Clinton and Donald Trump in that regard. She's awkward around people, socially awkward. And so I guess my question to you is about who she is at her core. She always seems like she is in a constant state of nervous breakdown, with the laughing inappropriately and the giggles and the shrieks and all this stuff, and she talks in circles. And I wonder if we could just play armchair shrink here for a moment, Charlie, because you've lived with this woman writing this book for a long time. God help you. Do you think she suffers from imposter syndrome? Meaning she knows she's a fraud. She knows she doesn't belong in any of these high positions, certainly not the VP. And so her subconscious kicks up and does the nervous laughter and talks in circles and all this other stuff because she knows deep, deep inside she doesn't belong there.
Right. When she gives talks to young people, she will frequently tell people, you belong here, you belong on this stage, and even though that you don't necessarily feel like you belong. And it is very much a product of her political career. She viewed everything as, I belong here, and if I show up and demand the position, I will usually get it. And in California, she did get it. When, mm-hmm. A woman of color shows up and makes demands, for a seat at the table, Democratic elites will usually give it to you. And so that's kind of how she ran her political career. But yeah, you point out so well that she really struggled to even communicate. And that's just a death knell when you're running for president, or you can kind of fake that when you're a senator. But when you're running for president, you can't do that. You have to be able to connect with voters, especially in today's modern social media age. I tell you, Monica, that was the biggest surprise for me, because revisiting her campaign for president, when I was reporting on that in 2020, I was focused more on Pete Buttigieg. But going back and looking at all her stumbles and problems from her campaign, it's shocking that these clear weaknesses were not more fully exposed during the presidential campaign.
Yeah, because nobody did the digging. Which you now have done, thanks, big thanks to you for doing that. But
the word salads were all there. The word signs were all there in that campaign.
Yeah, but the imperial media covers for all these people, so they didn't highlight it, and Biden was in the basement. I mean, the whole 2020 campaign was insane, and we learned nothing, and they wanted it that way. So let's talk about Black Lives Matter movement, because you write about this a lot in the book, Charlie, and you talk about how she used BLM to position herself as a potential VP candidate so that all of the people running for president, well, you know, ultimately including her, but that she would be a logical choice coming out of the BLM protests for any Democrat nominee to be, you know, at the top of their list. And it certainly worked. So how did she work that movement?
Yeah, it's very remarkable because of her record and background. You know, the left really did a good job at exposing her career as a law enforcement official, how she didn't open the doors to activists who are trying to fight police and hold police accountable for police shootings. She was not that kind of a prosecutor, not that type of attorney general when she was in California. And, you know, that's where the Kamala is a cop meme kind of stems. So many people were mocking Kamala as someone who would throw your kids in jail or throw parents in jail for not going, you know, for truancy. She was famous for that in California. So she wasn't sort of the natural figure that would be chosen to sort of, you know, represent this movement of police reform and the entire Black Lives Matter movement. But she did a very good job at manipulating her image, seizing on that moment, really focusing herself as a woman of color who was embracing this movement, who was very committed to the movement, really did a lot with media throughout that time. You know, any chance she got, she would step up to the camera and fuel and motivate the ongoing rioting that was taking place during 2020. Really positioning herself as someone who could speak about the movement and not embarrass herself. She was very scripted and very disciplined when she took the couple of months to put herself on that stage. With, you know, there is a huge part of it that is believable that she actually cared about the issue at that time, but it was also very political advantageous for her.
And also, didn't she work to spring a number of violent Antifa and BLM protesters from prison?
Right. That famous tweet where she endorsed the group in Minnesota that was paying for people's bail. So many of those people who ultimately were, you know, received bail from prison because of the protests went on to commit horrific crimes. And that's something that's kind of been swept under the rug by the mainstream media, but certainly conservative media did a really good job tracking those down.
So talk to us about how she ended up being Biden's nominee. You write about Barack Obama really working on her behalf. And then you write about Jill Biden, Dr. Jill, really arguing against taking Kamala Harris. What was going on in both of those situations?
Right. So in the summer of 2020, with all the rioting and the Black Lives Matter movement, most of Biden's advisors believed that he had to choose a woman of color. He had promised to choose a woman vice president during the waning days of the debates. But they believed he had to choose a woman of color if we are to motivate this part of our base, if we're going to, you know, put the band back together, the Obama coalition that brought them to victory. When it came time to look at qualified Democrat women, there was only a few that rose to the top of his list. And Susan Rice, former, you know, security advisor for President Obama, she quickly rose to the high ranks of the list, which was shocking from conservatives, right? Because she's most famously known for the Benghazi debacle. How mm-hmm. could Biden be considering someone like Susan Rice? But they actually had a pretty good friendship. And the family appreciated her and liked her. Jill Biden preferred Susan Rice. But, you know, Biden, I think he initially wanted Gretchen Whitmer, but he had to ultimately abandon that idea to pick a woman of color. And so the Biden campaign sort of went through a bunch of different candidates. Susan Bass was another one, but because of her communist ties to Castro, they had to abandon that idea. And ultimately, Obama was a big voice, a big advisor in this situation that, you know, urged the Biden family were not friends with Kamala. They felt that she stabbed Biden in the back during the debates, accusing him of being a racist. They saw that as a very hurtful, even, you know, because Kamala was famously friends with Beau Biden back in the day and even went to his funeral. And to have someone like that stab him in the back during the debate really hurt a lot of the Biden family. They were not happy with the idea of Kamala. But ultimately, Obama and a lot of Biden's senior advisors prevailed, convincing him to choose Kamala as his running mate.
Do you think they regret it?
I think they do. I think especially in the first years of the administration, I think there is a big regret there. But as I talk about in the book, they can't get rid of her without angering a huge portion of the Democratic base. And so they're kind of stuck with her. In some ways, it's a benefit because she hasn't outshined Biden, and there's no movement to demand Biden step down in favor of Kamala. I think there was a real likely people viewed that as a possibility when they first took office. But after her performance as vice president, I don't think you have that. So it might be a little bit of a boon for the Biden family going into the reelection.
Biden would not be the first president to choose a lame VP as an insurance policy. Charlie, okay. So he's not unique. She has been such a hot mess as vice president. That is evident for everybody to see. What's Biden's view of her now? And what's Jill's view of her now?
Well, the relationship with Jill is still frosty, right? There's never going to be a sisterhood there, right? I think that if you looked at the historic nature of the relationship, I think there's an opportunity for the two of them to be sisters, or, you know, kind of develop a friendship, a sisterhood. You know, you're the first woman vice president, I'm the first lady. We can get along and we can do some fun events together. But Kamala doesn't want that either. She views herself as the next president of the United States, and she wants to be treated that way. There's a lot of reporting and talking about how she was deeply offended if people didn't stand up when she entered the room. So Kamala wants to be treated that way. Jill doesn't view her. Jill's cordial, but she famously writes in her memoirs, you know, I'm fine with forgiving people who have hurt our family and who have hurt Joe, but I'm not very good at forgetting. So I think that relationship will always be frosty.
How does the staff in the White House view her? Because there have been all these stories over the last 3+ years that Kamala cannot seem to retain anybody.
Right. Her own office famously had, you know, a very sharp staff exodus. The team that she put together really fell apart in the first year. I think I counted 13 people in just the first 18 months, a steady rotation of people out of her office, really showing that she didn't put a good team together. And once people realized what it was like to work with her, didn't really want that abuse. She's known as sort of angry, hostile, and behind the scenes, not somebody that motivates staff. And I think there's a huge part of Washington staff that realizes they don't have a future there and that Kamala Harris doesn't have a future there. And even if she did, they don't want to work with her at that point. You kind of saw that with her campaign staff. People who worked on her vice presidential campaign chose to take lower levels in the West Wing rather than joining Kamala Harris. So even now, there's still a steady rotation of staffers leaving her office. It hasn't stopped, but it's a lot slower and a little less dramatic than it was in those first few years.
So her ultimate ambition is to be president. I guess final question for you, Charlie. What are the odds of that? I mean, as you look at the landscape now, we just made it through Super Tuesday. Let me take a step back and let me ask you this first. Joe Biden is people who say he's incompetent. I mean, he's basically senile, so he's incapacitated in that regard. Let's put it that way. So how dangerous has it been for the country and continues to be with an incapacitated president and a vice president who has no clue what she is doing?
Yeah, it's we're at a pretty tight spot right now, and I think a lot of voters see that. And it's 100% because of Biden's age and his inability to perform on camera. Anyone who sees, and even the Obama staffers that I've talked to, the former Obama staffers I talked to, say there's a visible change in Joe Biden's presence, and it's a big problem for the election, something they have to address. In the meantime, you have Kamala. That's the real problem. That's why the Democrat Party is still focused on pushing Biden across the finish line in November. It's a real big risk, but that's all they can do at this point. They can't replace Kamala Harris as vice president. They can't urge Joe Biden to step down without anointing Kamala Harris as his successor. I think that that's why they're sort of just trying to get him across the finish line at this point.
You know, she is still... Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Charlie.
Yeah, the only person that could replace Kamala Harris without angering a huge part of the base is a black woman. That's why you had, and you talked about it so well at CPAC, that's why you have so many rumors about Michelle Obama taking her place. Well, but yeah, earlier this week, Michelle Obama had to reassert herself and say, you know, through a spokesperson, saying that she will not be running for president in 2024. But that's sort of where we are now. And if Joe Biden can't make it, then we're I think you're in for real chaos at the top of the Democrat Party.
Also on Michelle, and thank you for your nice words. I first said this 2 years ago on the main stage of CPAC, and everybody gasped when I mentioned the possibility of Michelle, and now everybody's on the Michelle bandwagon. But as you point out, her spokesperson this week said she is not running. I would just say, and I did this in my monologue today, not so fast. Notice that she did not say she was not running. She had a spokesperson do it. So anything is still possible. But getting back to Kamala, you know, in your final moment here too, Charlie, paint a picture of what a Kamala Harris presidency would look like.
Right. I think that Kamala Harris is sort of looking at this as she believes everyone's underestimating her. And, you know, if you look at it, Joe Biden had experienced the same thing when he was vice president. No one expected him to run, certainly in 2016. And even in 2020, they underestimated him. They considered him a bumbling fool who was, you know, just a second fiddle to Obama. But he really stepped up and made it happen despite the entire groaning of the elite about his political presence. So Kamala has to have this calculation. If Joe Biden made this happen, maybe I can do it too. And if she becomes president by Joe Biden stepping down, I think you're going to have a real vengeful Kamala Harris. She will do a lot to clean house, get rid of a lot of the top staff that she feels have mistreated her throughout her vice presidency. And I think she's going to really make a move to reassert herself on the national stage. And certainly the media aren't going to be happy with how she acts, because she has a lot of grievances there, too. So I think it'll be someone who has a lot of grievances and a lot of score settling. And I think that will sort of mark her presidency if she ever takes over for Joe Biden.
God forbid. Charlie, God forbid. If you think the Biden presidency is a horror show, just wait until Kamala's in there. I mean, it really brings chills to everybody. I think every right-thinking American just braces for this. And that's something that Trump and the Trump campaign should be talking about. You're not voting for Joe Biden. You're voting for her. And that should chill everybody.
Yeah, Nikki Haley did such a good job of doing that during her campaign. Her campaign, you know, has ended today, but she did a very good job of pointing out it's a question of me or Kamala Harris. And you would think that the Trump campaign would really like to move towards that as we get closer to November as well.
Well, they should as well. The book is fantastic. It's called Amateur Hour, Kamala Harris in the White House. The author is the great Charlie Spearing. The book is available wherever you get your books, so Amazon, wherever. Go get it. It is a fun read. It's also equally horrifying, but we need to know what we're up against here as we go into November. So get a hold of this book. Charlie, thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you, Monica.
Okay, guys, that is going to do it for me today. Thank you so much for joining me and for checking out our great sponsors. Have a fantastic end to your week, and I'm going to see you right back here next week with some huge shows, including Jack Posobiec and Ambassador Rick Grenell. We're going to cover a lot next week with huge guests, so be here or be square. Have a great weekend. This episode of the Monica Crowley Podcast was produced by Behakel Entertainment, LLC.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right.
The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.